The scripture reading is taken from 1 Samuel 25, 2 through 12. 1 Samuel 25, 2 through 12. And there was a man in Maon whose business was in Carmel. The man was very rich. He had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. He was shearing his sheep in Carmel. Now the name of the man was Nabal, and the name of his wife Abigail. The woman was discerning and beautiful, but the man was harsh and badly behaved. He was a Calebite. David heard in the wilderness that Nabal was shearing his sheep. So David sent 10 young men. And David said to the young men, "Go up to Carmel and go to Nabal and greet him in my name. And thus you shall greet him, 'Peace be to you, and peace be to your house, and peace be to all that you have. I hear that you have shearers. Now your shepherds have been with us, and we did them no harm. And they missed nothing all the time they were in Carmel. Ask your young men, and they will tell you. Therefore, let my young men find favor in your eyes, for we come on a feast day. Please give whatever you have at hand to your servants and to your son David." When David's young men came, they said all this to Nabal in the name of David, and then they waited. And Nabal answered David's servants, "Who is David? Who is the son of Jesse? There are many servants these days who are breaking away from their masters. Shall I take my bread and my water and my meat that I have killed for my shearers and give it to men who come from I do not know where?" So David's young men turned away and came back and told him all this.
I want to thank Justin for leading that particular song that we sang just before the sermon here. Those of you had not grown up in the church, that's a blessing. But then for those of us that have grown up in the church, we wind up with some interesting things, one of which I remember, I don't know how many times, hearing that song or having that song sung as preparation for the Lord's Supper. And it is the only thing I can figure out is in the title, "Break Thou the Bread of Life." And somehow I think but when you read the words, when you listen to the words, it has nothing whatsoever in the words of the song to do with the Lord's Supper. Sometimes we do not really sing with the understanding, I believe. So it's good to sing, be able to see that particular song placed really as a type of song. It was intended to be more as a sermon preparation or one dealing with breaking to us the bread of life from the Word of God. I want to take this opportunity to welcome everyone that's here. We have a pretty fair number this morning. And we want to welcome you, let you know that we're glad that you're here. If you're visiting with us, we want you to know that we're especially glad that you're here. And we want to invite you to come back anytime you may have in the future. 1 Samuel chapter 25 contains within its verses a very interesting story. And you could probably sum up the story as being the story of how Abigail came to be the wife of David. But you have to wonder, why is this story recorded at all? After all, Abigail was not David's first wife. It wasn't that okay, here's his first wife and here's how he came to take her as his wife. Ahinoam was his first wife, and we really don't even know much about her. It isn't that their son was of anyone of importance. Chileab was mentioned once, and after that, never again. And the assumption is that he died at a fairly young age, because he was never in consideration for being in the line for the throne. But what I think we have, we can speculate all day long, is exactly why God decided to include this particular story of David here in 1 Samuel. But nevertheless, as we begin to look at this story, this narrative, I think we'll see some very important lessons, and I'm hopeful that when we leave here this morning, that all of us will be able to leave with some very important lessons as a consequence of examining this particular passage. You know, there are many things that you can come up with on your list of things that you would really categorize as making your day. And we could spend a great deal of time listing those things. But I can just about guarantee that nobody, in compiling such a list, would put on that list someone coming and correcting them about something they may have said or something that they may have done. Nobody enjoys the idea of being corrected, of having an error pointed out that they have made in the past. And so often what we find is that they come from individuals that really it's even more painful because of who it comes from. Perhaps our spouse. I don't want to ever have it pointed out by my wife that somehow I failed her. And it makes it even more difficult when she does point out that, you know, you messed up here and maybe you need to do this a little different in the future. Your boss, no one likes to have it pointed out by their boss that they've fallen short, they've fallen down on the job. Maybe you thought you were doing a good job, but as it turns out, no, you really weren't. And you need to improve on your quality. Or maybe a close friend comes to you and they point out that you've made a huge mistake somewhere and you need to make amends, you need to make changes, some correction in your life. And you've disappointed your friend and you've saddened them because of something you have said or perhaps done. What we're going to do is to note, look at an example here of where David is being rebuked for something he is about to do. If we were to ask about an instance in David's life where he was rebuked, I think the first one that would really, without any problems at all, almost every one of us would talk about Nathan going to him after David had committed adultery with Bathsheba and murdered Uriah the Hittite and tried to cover it up. And that would be an excellent example. But we have another example here in 1 Samuel chapter 25 where David once again is being rebuked. And yet we find an example of just exactly why the scriptures refer to him as a man after God's own heart. The background of our story is this. David has been on the run, been on the lam, trying to stay away from Saul. Saul has decided that he's public enemy number one, and anybody that would tell him where David was, I'll come get him and I will take him out. So what David has done, Saul is up here in this area here, here's Gibeah, here's where Saul lives, and he's trying to continue to consolidate the power and get his kingdom fully established. He's had some battles with the Philistines, and he's fought them off to some extent, but he's still trying to consolidate his power. Now, he's not really doing a good job. And the reason is because he's not working with God, and he's continuing to do things his way. But nevertheless, so he's taken up with trying to deal with the issues. He's got the rest of the nation here to deal with, to try and fight off or make sure that he doesn't have enemies coming in to invade him from up here. So David flees down here to the south to get away from Saul. And so for the most part, he's out of sight and out of mind. And so Saul has more important problems to deal with, and he's working on doing that. So David is down here in this particular area here. Here's Maon, and here's Carmel, as Joe read to us about where Nabal lived and where he worked. And so David is down here in this area. And one of the things we want to note about this particular point in time is that because Saul's still trying to consolidate his power and really get his kingdom established, for these areas down here, if you lived in this area, there really was no police or military to help protect you. Borders, there's no borders down here. And so you were subject to, for instance, the Amalekites coming in, and they would make a raid and steal whatever you have. Maybe even take you away and sell you into slavery. Edomites may make a raid in here, or even the Moabites. And so you had other nomadic tribes down here, types of individuals, and they would come and make a raid. So that there was no way of really protecting yourself in this area. Well, David comes down here. He has 600 men with him. And what he basically does is he sets himself up as the military force for this area and sort of the police as well. And he helps to make sure that those individuals down here that had flocks and herds, that their animals were protected and that there wouldn't be anyone coming down here to raid them and to be able to haul off what property would belong to those Israelites down here. So as time goes on, there comes a feast day, as Joe read to us, and David decides what he would do is send 10 men to go and to ask for some favors, some food from Nabal. Now, when they had a sheep shearing time, it was a time of festivities. It was a feast day. It was a day which typically individuals would share. And so David goes and sends his men and he says, look, we didn't ask anything of you when we were watching over your herds for you, helping you to protect you. And nothing was ever missing. We could have decided, look, we're your police force and we're hungry, so we're going to go take an animal or two, or we're going to take some food, or we're going to come demand that you give us some food. And David said, we never did that. We stayed off by ourselves, and you were able to live your lives peaceably, and you were able to raise your animals. And so would you share with us? And Nabal not only says no, he says no in an insulting way. And basically says to David, you're a nothing. Now we read later on in the story, his wife Abigail is fully cognizant of the prophecies and what's going to happen to David in the future, that he is going to be the king of Israel. So we have to assume that Nabal knew as well. So Nabal says, ain't no way, ain't no how. I'm not dealing with any ne'er-do-well such as David. So they go back and they report this, and David then says, well, that's it. We're going to do something about this. Abigail hears about what's happened, and so she decides, she says, get some food together to her servants, and she says, get out of here and get this off to David. And she gets on a donkey, and she's going to, or an animal, and she's going to go, and she's going to go make an entreaty to David herself. And eventually she does. She goes to David, and she begs him to reconsider what he is about to do. And so what we want to do then is to look at the fact that exactly what it was that that took place here, and look at the lessons that we can derive from this. One of the things that we want to note here about what transpired here when Abigail and David met is to note that Abigail came and she gave a rebuke to David. In effect, that's what happened. And what we want to note here is that it was a carefully administered rebuke. And the reason for that is David was wrong. Absolutely wrong. First of all, he was on his way to return evil for evil. That's exactly what he was about to do. In Deuteronomy chapter 32, the song of Moses that is sung there, God through Moses makes the following statement. He says, vengeance is mine and recompense. For the time when their foot shall slip, for the day of their calamity is at hand, and their doom comes swiftly, for the Lord will vindicate his people and have compassion on his servants. There in verse 35 and the first part of verse 36. So David already had clearly indicated to him that he would that he did not have a basis for striking out, and what he was going to do is he clearly indicates there that he says that not a single male was going to be living the next day. And he had every intention of wiping out all of the males of Nabal's household. So he was going to execute murder and vengeance of his own because of the insult that Nabal had made to David and in denying him sharing the food. We have this same principle taught to us as Christians today. Paul wrote in Romans chapter 12 that we are to repay no one evil for evil, but give thought to do what is honorable in the sight of all. Beloved, never avenge yourselves, but leave it to the wrath of God, for it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. Peter goes a step further, and he gives us instead not just simply how we're to handle when we're given evil, but rather he takes it a step further and he says, finally there in 1 Peter 3 and verses 8 and 9, finally, all of you have unity of mind, sympathy, brotherly love, a tender heart, and a humble mind. Do not repay evil for evil or reviling for reviling, but on the contrary, bless. For to this you were called, that you may obtain a blessing. I couldn't help but remember or think back upon Justin's lesson not too long ago about looking at brotherly love as I read and studied this passage. That we need to have the attitude with our brothers that when they say or do something that hurts us deeply, that instead of lashing out with another insult or a form of retribution, that instead we need to look for some way of blessing them. And you can take that however, any number of ways you can define blessing there. But it certainly doesn't mean trying to give, as Peter indicates there, giving, reviling someone because they've reviled you, or to return the evil that they have given to you, whether intentional or not. The charts here, once again, not exactly in the order they should be. But the other thing that David was on his way to do was to shed blood without cause. And that's exactly what he said there. I believe it's verse 31 that he, it's what Abigail says there in verse 31, where she says, "My Lord shall have no cause of grief or pangs of conscience for having shed blood without cause, or my Lord for my Lord taking vengeance on himself." David agreed with her, yes, I would have been taking blood, shedding blood without cause. And that is not that he wasn't justified in the from the standpoint of having been insulted. David had been insulted. But as Deuteronomy 32 indicated, it wasn't up to David to be the one to punish Nabal for what he did to David. And so David understood at this point in time, and after she had said this, that, yep, you're absolutely right. She also sends a large food gift. And as we indicated, she's going to go and find David. Note that her manner, once she was able to find him, it indicated complete humility. She got down from the donkey in verse 23 and fell before David on her face and bowed to the ground. Now, I recognize that what she did was in the custom of that day as to how one did show humility. But my point in all of this is she was in the right. And yet she took great pains to demonstrate that she was coming to David with great humility, that she was not arrogant in any way in rebuking him. Secondly, she took full responsibility for the insult. Now she did point out that, yes, it's my husband, but yet she said, look, Let you just blame me. Don't blame him. He can't help it, because that's the way he is. But blame me, and as a result, then maybe you won't be so keen on taking vengeance for this insult that's been handed to you. Thirdly, she claimed that the Lord had held David back from doing wrong. Presumably, by her going to David and pointing this matter out to him. And finally she says, look, one of these days you're going to be king. And when you are king, you don't want to look back on this incident with regret. You don't want to look back on this incident and be remembering that, yeah, he did say something that wasn't very nice to me, but I was really heavy-handed with my response. And I really didn't have the right to take his or his male descendants' lives. And she's saying, you don't want to have that hanging over you after you're king. Well, not only was this rebuke carefully administered, it was gratefully received. When you consider the fact that this was probably the epitome of a misogynistic age, At this point in time, women had no value as far as society went, other than bearing children, providing you with heirs. That's about all society really held for the value of a woman. And to have a woman come up and rebuke you? The temptation would be clearly to say, "Who are you? I don't have to listen to you." David instead says, "You know, you're right." He says that that yes, this entreaty that you're giving me, it's really from the Lord. And he says, "I'm wrong to engage in this." There's not a whole lot of time to really say to spend time on this. When someone says, "Yes, you're right, I'm wrong," that's the end of the discussion right there. So what are the lessons now that we want to look at, we want to absorb for ourselves as we begin to look at this incident in total? Well, the first thing we want to ask ourselves is, do we see others pointing out our errors as helping us to heaven? Are they there to really help us? Do we view them that way? Do we perhaps see them that way by recognizing that it's a difficult task? We talk about Nathan going to David. And oh yeah, he went, he was able to tell this great parable. And then he was finally able to say, "You're the man." Wasn't Nathan a lucky guy? I want you to know, if Nathan wasn't scared to death walking to the palace, then he didn't have an ounce of brains in his head. He was going to the king. And typically, monarchs in that day and age, when you told them they're wrong, it was a death sentence for you. Furthermore, it still took courage for Nathan to go to David, even though he might have known what the end result was going to be. Because of the fact that he had not only fearful for his own life, it could have been fearful for his reputation. David may not have decided to kill him. Perhaps he decided would still instead try to damage his reputation. When we have a brother or sister come to us, point out that we have erred in some way, do we really take time to stop and consider? You know, it takes some guts to go tell someone you're wrong or you've made a mistake here. For one thing, they might be damaged, potentially losing a friend. Or they, you know, that's assuming they don't have to duck as a result of what they tell that individual. We need to remember, someone comes to us to tell us that perhaps we've done something wrong. It takes a little bit of time. Here's one that I find is really interesting. Do we see it as answering prayer for them to come to us? I've given the example of so often we pray to God, "God, please protect me and keep me from harm." So I'm driving to the store and somebody cuts me off. And what do? Angry. I said, "What are you trying to do? Is my cloaking device on? What's wrong?" And they'll get upset with them. And it's very possible that what God has just done is kept you from being on down the road several seconds later when somebody decides they're just going to race through a red light. God may have just saved your life by causing that car to cut you off. and keep you from being on down the road. So often we miss that. So we read verses in the Bible, especially ones that like this, that David wrote, "Keep back your servant also from presumptuous sins. Let them not have dominion over me, then I shall be blameless and innocent of great transgression." This is a prayer recorded by David. And we read that and we say, "Yes, God, please keep me from presumptuous sin." And then somebody comes to us and they say, "You don't want to do this, or you've started down the road where this is wrong." And what do we want to do? We want to lash out at them. And we say, "God, why didn't you stop me from you do something? I asked you, please don't let me do." And he said, "I sent somebody to you and you rejected him." Another example, Psalm 141, verses 8 through 9. "But my eyes are toward you, O God, my Lord. In you I seek refuge. Leave me not defenseless. Keep me from the trap they have laid for me and from the snares of evildoers." God may be doing just exactly that when someone comes to us to point out error that we may have committed in our lives. There's also the closing verse in the model prayer given by Jesus in Matthew chapter 6. "Deliver us from evil." Oh yes, Lord, deliver us from evil. Well, okay, I sent somebody to you to try and keep you from doing wrong, and you at least verbally smacked them away. Certainly ignored them. Finally, do we see others pointing our errors and to reject this by being grateful for their love for us? Stop, think about that. Somebody comes to you to point out the fact that perhaps you're guilty of sin. They're not doing it because they don't like you. If they didn't like you, they wouldn't come tell you. Let you just go on your merry little way. They come to you because they love you. We need to respect that, recognize that when someone does come to us, it's done so out of love. Do we try, when they do come to us, do we try to turn the spotlight on the one correcting us? Do we accuse them of ulterior motives? "Well, you know, you're just trying to make yourself feel better. You're just trying to build yourself up." Do we try and point out their sins? "Well, what about you, you know? Have you ever considered about this other situation over here?" No, wait a minute. The topic for discussion is what you have done, not what they may have done. That's another subject for another time. But you're not going to change the truth of what you may have done by suddenly switching topics and saying, "Well, let's talk about this over here that you're guilty of." Not at all indicative of a desire to want to go to heaven. Do you try and be critical of their methods? I'll tell you right now, brothers and sisters are just downright clumsy sometimes when they try and point out the errors of brothers and sisters. That's because we're all human. I truly wish that I had the wisdom of Solomon, that I would know exactly how to point out to individuals times when I've observed them doing things that I didn't think were appropriate. And I could choose the right words or the right time or the right method. But being human, I can't. But I'll tell you what, for me to sit there and do nothing is even worse. And there have been times when I resolved I'm not going to do nothing about this. And I may have been clumsy about it, but I at least couldn't be accused of doing nothing. Do we try and turn the tables on them and say, well, wait a minute, I don't like your attitude? Or maybe you could have waited at another time to be able to bring this up. So many times we try and be critical of those that are trying to help us to heaven. We need to search our souls. Find that humility that Christ had, being able to endure what individuals would try and do to us and not try and lash back at them. But try and understand exactly what the situation is. When we do go to someone to try and express to them our concern for what they have or haven't done, do we try and do it with humility? Or do we take a superior tone and attitude? You know, you really should. This once again, you're at it again. You know, I would not have done that. Or do we try and go to them, say, with the understanding we're trying to save their souls? James chapter 5, last two verses of the book of James. My brothers, if anyone among you wanders from the truth and someone brings him back, let him know that whoever brings back a sinner from his wandering will save his soul from death and will cover a multitude of sins. And someone says, well, that's talking about someone who just completely walks away from God. I want to know, how do you know that this, whatever it is that you're being rebuked for, that won't lead to your wandering away and leaving God altogether? Whether it's going off into apostasy, whether it's deciding that you don't have to serve God any longer, or killing your first love altogether for Christ. If we're able to go to a brother or sister and be able to save their souls from an error that they're committing, then certainly this passage would still nevertheless apply. And we would be able to say that we've covered a multitude of sins. Do we try and go to, when we do correct someone, do we maybe perhaps instead try to seek punishment for them? I want to see some punishment. They've been guilty of this, or they've been guilty of that. I want to see them suffer because it'll make me feel better. Or maybe we're not after open punishment. Perhaps we instead decide, well, we'll just go tell a few people, you know, this is what they've been guilty of. And they've done, I know this for a fact. And so you wind up just really assassinating their character by spreading not tales, but the truth that instead needed to be covered up. Our conclusions. We serve an awesome God. He gives us His Word, which is also the gospel. He also sends us messengers to correct us, to help us toward heaven. And the beauty of the gospel is it not only convicts us of sin, but shows us that forgiveness is available through Jesus Christ. We serve an awesome God because He loves us. He wants us all to go to heaven. So He gives us His Word to instruct us. He occasionally sends us messengers to help point out errors that either we've committed or we're about to commit. We looked at this next one when we studied David in 1 Samuel. But I think this is so important for us to be reminded of from time to time. True measure of our character is not the things we do or don't do in our life. You want a true measure of your character? And you see how you respond to rebuke. If you're going to give someone the stiff arm, or if you're going to say, talk to the hand, that says far more about your character to someone trying to help you to get to heaven than anything you might go out here, no matter all the great things you might decide to do. No matter how much Bible you know, no matter how much you may do in your life, how pious you may absolutely appear to be. If you can't handle rebuke, then it says a tremendous amount about your character right there. Finally, we get to Judgment Day. I want you to know, you get to Judgment Day. That person that came to you and said that you had committed some sin or you'd made an error of some kind, you're not going to care about the embarrassment or the hurt to your pride that you had to suffer as a consequence. You're not going to care one bit. What's going to be vitally important to you is whether or not your name is written in the book. And if you were stubborn, if you didn't listen, if you denied what the person said, and were interested more in how you appeared to everyone around you, you may not find your name written in that book. Probably won't. And the embarrassment that you would have suffered so momentarily, you would have gladly suffered at that point in time. One of the things to note here as we read in this story, David was faced with the decision of doing right or wrong. He could continue on the course that he had set to go and wipe out Nabal and all of his descendants. Or he could stop and consider what Abigail was saying to him and say, you know, this is wrong. And that's exactly what he did. If you're here today, you've got the same decision to decide as to whether you're going to do right or wrong. And it doesn't matter what kind of a situation you may find yourself in. It's a decision every one of us need to face every day in the future. If you're here and you're not a Christian, you've got to decide. Are you going to continue serving Satan? Or are you going to make the decision to serve God? You've got that decision to make here. Or if you're already a Christian, could be a faithful child of God. You still need to be deciding every day just exactly what it is you're going to do about the various temptations. And when faced with rebuke, whether it's from a spouse, whether it's from a friend or a brother or sister, or whether it's from your boss at work, might even be a stranger. We have to decide how we're going to handle that, how we're going to respond to it. Was it with humility or with pride and with arrogance? But you could be a faithful, could be one that has been a Christian and you've fallen away. and you recognize that you're that you have indeed left your first love, and that you're badly in need of the forgiveness of God, and that you want the help of the congregation to help restore yourself to faithful service to Him. However we can help you, we ask that you come to the front and let us know as we stand and sing the song.